welcome to the pilot episode of Echoes from the Canyons, a retrospective music podcast. I'm your host, Ash Sider, and with me is your co-host, Jimmy Sider. Today, we're going to delve into part one of a two-part series on David Crosby and the end of the Crosby era with the Byrds. Some of you may already know that David Crosby was one of the original founding members of the band, one of the original five. He would have been the second to leave the band after Gene Clark had already moved on several years before this. So we're just going to dive right in here and just see what happens. Just a friendly reminder that this podcast contains a lot of adult language and a lot of adult subject matter. If conversations about sex, drugs, and illegal activities makes you a little bit uncomfortable, or if you're underage and not supposed to be listening to this type of material, this show is definitely not for you. Welcome to the show. Let's kind of set this up. So David's not committed at this point to the Byrds necessarily. He's kind of starting to have some issues and starting to just generally not give a shit. So let's start there. Let's talk about that dynamic and kind of where we're at with David on his transition out of the band.
My boy Dave, from the time I met him, from the time I started with the band and got to know David, he never really was committed to the band. That was my take on him. He was in the band, yes. He was a pain in the ass in the band, yes. Everybody in the band knew that. And I was warned by Michael, by Chris, never by McGuinn, really, that he was difficult. And Eddie, their manager, who basically told me to handle it, warned me about David also, that he was going to be difficult to deal with. And in reality, he was difficult to deal with. Everybody was always on pins and needles about pissing him off. Don't piss him off. Leave him alone. If he's sitting over there reading his book, just leave him. On an airplane, for instance, or flying to New York, leave him. He'll bitch about the food, the length of the flight. He'll bitch about anything. Don't disturb him. Leave him alone.
Is this like the basis for the rules of the road? Does that come from the band or did that come directly from David?
The rules of the road were directly from David. He did it like it was a defense mechanism for him, basically. That was his defense mechanism to show that he was in control. Because we'd get the rental car, the keys are laying there, and I would throw them to McGuinn, usually or sometimes, and David would take them from him, which meant David was driving. Did David know where we were going? I don't know. He said he did, but they had the phone number for the hotel. If they got lost, they could call the hotel. But they, just like me, had to stop at a payphone. Oh, they never stopped, okay? If they were lost, they never asked direction. That's one of David's rules.
Never ask directions?
Never ask directions. If you're lost, do what? Not stop and ask directions, okay?
So what are the other rules?
Oh, the other rules. And this is an assimilation of the rules over time that I remember.
So they changed.
They changed. Time. They would change from time to time. Yes, of course. So basically with a car, for a rental car, which were quite common, every city, never a green car. At the Hertz counter, you didn't know what color the car was. But they always wanted a Cadillac or a Lincoln. And I would have to be the dumbass that said, the car can't be green. And the chick behind the counter or the guy behind the counter would look at me and go, what? The car can't be green? I said, yeah, that you heard me. Anyway, in the car, no loud music. Only one navigator. Only speak when spoken to. No dope smoked. Unless the driver was smoking. And of course, it would be usually David.
What was the reasoning behind that one? Like, the driver needs to be getting high with us, too.
What was the reason behind any of them? Okay.
Good point.
Never mind that one.
Valid point.
I mean, you know what I mean? Okay. No stopping unless David wanted to stop. If lost, never stop to ask. Okay.
Okay. Just be lost.
Yeah. Just be lost. If following another car, no red lights will be run or yellow either. If these rules were not followed, you would be killed immediately. No food in the car. No booze in the car. no chicks in the car. That was cars. Airplanes, airlines, basically.
Oh, God.
No green airplanes. Texas International had some green airplanes. And he actually refused to take one once because that was the plane that was there. He must have the window seat, meaning David. No one should talk to him on a plane. If he sleeps, don't wake him for food or anything else. Never seat him next to Michael. Keep other passengers away from him, i.e. people who want autographs, whatever, okay? Always board the plane before all the other passengers. Well, that one kind of had to get changed because in the early days, there were used two doors. They had one in the first class compartment, which was ours, and one in the back. So we would board first in first class if they weren't all walking through first class, okay?
Right.
But then later, they started only using one door, and they used the front door. So all the people in the back would truck through the first class compartment, and we would enter the plane last. Hotel rules. Now you leave and you go to the hotel, okay? The hotel rules. Keep his room quiet, wherever it was. Keep him quiet. 24-hour room service, a must. Keep the room away from the others if possible. That was stupid, okay? Located conveniently to airports, but not cities. Okay?
So basically staying outside, south side.
Yeah, staying closer to the airport than going right across from the concert hall.
Mm.
Okay? Not too far from the gig, but not too close either. Okay?
right in that middle.
I.e. across the street, okay? Because a lot of times, we're playing the big arena in the city, and Holiday Inn or Hilton would have a hotel right there. Sometimes they were connected to the arena with a walkway, okay? He didn't want to be anywhere near that kind of shit. Concert rules. No reporters before a show. You can kind of get that.
Yeah, I get some of these. Some of these are not terrible.
Yeah. No guests before a show. He was dead against that big time. Wives, girlfriends, no. No talking after the show. What? keep the press away as long as possible. Leave as soon as possible after a show. Talking to the audience from stage was never to be done.
That is stupid. That one's really dumb.
Okay. Well, okay, you have to realize in those days, in the early days, the audiences were not like they are today. They weren't educated to the music, really, or the concert. So they were different. And
like in what ways?
Just younger, dumber. Okay, screaming and yelling, trying to jump on the stage.
Okay.
I mean, stuff like that. And to talk to them was a waste of time, first of all, because normally the PA system wasn't good enough for them to hear you. If you're in an auditorium, there's 10,000
screaming fans.
People there.
Yeah.
And 9,000 of them are girls. Screaming, Michael, Michael, Chris, Chris, Dave. No, not David. Okay. They wouldn't scream for David, really. But screaming nonetheless, okay? If you've never been in an audience where that many people with the all screaming, you'd understand why you don't talk to them. My first real experience with that was many years later with David Cassidy when we were outside even. 18,000 people or more outside in Australia. And with all the girls screaming David at the top of their lungs, not just when he came on stage, all day, starting at noon when I started to set up. And the show was maybe at 4 o'clock.
Wow.
They were screaming David's name all day. So did they? How the fuck they had a voice? I don't know. And throwing teddy bears, koalas, okay? Because some PR person said David loves koala bears.
Oh man!
So I would get—I swear to you—100 koala bears on stage for Cassidy every show. And it was like, what am I going to do with these? Well, we bagged them up. The ladies from the singers and I, we bagged them up and took them to hospitals, children's hospitals.
Oh, that's awesome.
In David's name, of course. He didn't go, but we did with all these koalas. Because what are you going to do with them? I mean, seriously, 20 trash bags full of koala bears? For fuck's sake. Okay.
God.
Yeah, it was horrible. The birds didn't have that so much, but you did have fans that would have McGuinn glasses.
Sure.
Okay. And David capes. All right.
Because he wore a cape.
He wore a cape. He wore that leather cape and that nasty thing. I mean, the sweat from a show was a lot.
Who told him to wear a cape?
The Beatles. they didn't tell him. They were imitating the Beatles. McGuinn had the bird glasses. All right.
Yeah.
He didn't need glasses. He has bad eyes, but he didn't need those glasses. They weren't prescription glasses. They were just glasses.
Right.
They were just, yeah, weird shaped glasses to be somewhat like John Lennon, if you will. Lennon needed glasses because he was really poor sighted. All right. Roger didn't need the glasses. Okay. And they wore Beetle boots and skinny pants.
Right, right.
All right. And straightened their hair to be like, you know, when you look at the first promotional photos that they took.
Oh, yeah. There's similarities there. Yeah, for sure.
You've seen those. And then they had to take more because Gene left. The first promotional photos Gene was in. So then they had to take quickly, they had to take new ones.
Right.
And the pictures I got were the ones where they're sitting on a car, they're sitting in a tree. I mean, and, you know, long hair and all, you know, the glasses and the hat and the cape.
The cape, man.
You know, the leather cape. And, you know, it's hot enough on stage sometimes. You don't need to wear a fucking leather cape.
Do you think David ever still wears a leather cape?
No.
But like around
I think he does?
Around
no.
the house.
No, fuck
you know?
No.
Like
no.
In private.
I don't think so. I don't
just
think
relives
so.
His, I mean,
it'd be interesting to know that for the, you know, I could see, you know, David, in the end, David probably is a much more real person than McGuinn or Hillman, but not more real than Michael Clark and Gene Clark. But David was a really sweet person down deep inside. And he didn't prove that to me often, but he did prove it to me a few times where, you know, he would say things to me on an airplane. He would thank me for something that I did for him. All right. Whatever it was. Hey, man, thanks for getting me my guitar. And he was sincere and he meant it. Okay. He wasn't bullshit. Okay. It was nice. And he did that at the very beginning. He actually winked. He would wink at me. He would say something ridiculous to everyone in the room, and then he'd look at me and wink, which basically means that's all bullshit. What I just said is all bullshit.
Right.
Okay. So don't pay any attention to it. But that's David. And he, as I said, I've said it before many times, he had a twinkle in his eye, and he still does. I just saw him recently on some TV show, and he still has that twinkle in his eye. And that twinkle gets him. He gets away with murder, all right? He gets away with murder, no doubt in my mind. Now, straight out the bag, first show we did in Texas, okay, when he talked to the sheriff or the whatever that cop was.
Oh, yes. Okay. I know the story.
Well, and I told him, I said, David, you pissed him off, and I'm sure we're going to come back to Dallas many times in our career, and you're not going to get over that. You're not going to get past that with him because he's a normal guy. He's just a police chief. Hello. Guess where David went to jail?
Dallas.
Thank you. I don't know. Actually, I don't know if it was Dallas.
But
I wasn't
Texas.
With him then. But he had a gun on him, and I think he had some drugs on him.
Was it in Texas?
It was in Texas, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, because David always thought he was invincible. He really did. He thought he was invincible.
Common mistake.
Ah, Birmingham, Alabama, where, you know, David's thing of, oh, put my room away from everybody else, blah, 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 blah. Well, he was a few doors down from everybody, but that's as far as I could get him. And we stayed in a hotel. Birmingham, Alabama, all right? What the fuck were we doing playing in Birmingham, Alabama in those days?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, the agents knew, but, you know, they made the offer. And this was when agents were like, we had a bunch of different agents, okay? And this was a one-off for one of the agents. And so we're in this hotel in Birmingham. And in the hotel is the tractor convention, okay, for Birmingham, Alabama. All the reps from the tractors and farmers were there.
Yeah.
Staying in the hotel, having a couple of days of whatever they talk about at a tractor convention. Hey, the new X-47 or whatever. Okay. And then, you know, so you see that, you know that, and you know to stay away from that. I mean, and I told them in the lobby, I said, did you see that? You know, they had a thing, a placard there on a stand. I said, did you see that? And they're like, what? Tractor convention upstairs, second floor, okay, for 2 days.
Yeah.
And those guys are probably staying in the hotel. So be cool, stay in your rooms. Okay, well, I go down to the lobby to check something out at the desk to make sure we're set for the next day, whatever. As I'm going back to the room, David is in the gift shop buying a book. He's wearing his hat, curly hair sticking out underneath it.
You mean his fur hat?
Yeah. No, not the fur hat. He had a blue one.
Okay.
Wasn't fur. He had a blue velvet hat.
Okay.
He's wearing that with his hair sticking out, and okay, he's wearing casual clothes. And so we walk together to the elevator, and we get in the elevator, and it's empty. Boom. Press our floor, which is fifth floor, sixth floor, whatever. And on the second floor, this huge farmer guy gets in, not wearing coveralls, wearing kind of a brown suit coat and a weird tie. He gets in, and he's drunk. He's been at the party or whatever they're doing.
He's kind of tipsy. Powwow.
Yeah, he's kind of tipsy, and he's looking at Dave. And Dave looks up at him and goes, what the fuck are you looking at? And I'm like, oh, man, you could have chose 100 things to say, but not that, okay? I didn't say anything. I just tried to step between him and this guy.
Mm-hmm.
The guy wanted to grab him right then and there. And I said, no. So we got to our floor, we got off. He was going higher than we were. So fine. Dave goes to the room. I go, Dave, please, okay, tractor convention, please, stay in your room. Fine. About 20 minutes later, I hear something going on in the hallway, and it's at Dave's room. The door's open, there's a bunch of loud noise and stuff, and the guys, the other rooms, were the other side. Everybody had their own room, okay, always.
Right.
Never shared rooms. They're to the left, Dave's to the right. So I called downstairs and I said, you know, get somebody up here from security. Why? Some guy's causing trouble with one of my guys. I go down to his room, the door's open, and this guy has David by the neck. David's feet were off the floor. Because this guy was really he was like 6'5 or something. Okay, he was a big guy. And he's got him by the throat, and he's holding him against the wall. Okay.
Jesus.
And I'm like, what the fuck? And the guy turns and looks at me, right? But he didn't drop David. He kept him up there, right? So I grabbed that, you know, that metal luggage rack that they have in rooms?
Yeah.
I grabbed that fucking thing and slammed this guy in the back so he would drop him. Which he did, and then he came after me, and I went out in the hallway, and he followed me into the hallway, and by then, the security guys were there, and I just said, take him away, all right? He's in my guy's room, and he's trying to choke him to death. And Dave's, like, on the floor, and I said, come on, dude, you all right? Drink something. You know, he's a singer, all right? He's one of our singers.
Right.
And he just had his, choked up, but, you know. Who walked up to the guy and said, what the fuck are you looking at?
Okay, right.
It wasn't me.
Right.
Okay. But that's David, all right? I don't know if he even told the other guys this or not. I was just shocked. I had to go downstairs and they took the guy away in the police car. Okay.
Yeah.
I had to sign some shit and tell him what happened and blah, blah. So I was down there a while and I come back up and I knock on his door. I said, it's Jimmy. So he opens the door, and I said, dude, what the fuck? Why did you open the door? He said, I just barely opened it, and he fucking jammed it in my face.
Sure.
Okay, well,
How did he know where he was staying?
I don't know how he got to the room. He might have knocked on every door on the floor for all.
Yeah, well, he was drunk, right? So
yeah, he was drunk. Anyway, that was Dave. Okay, that was just and it's Birmingham, Alabama, too, at the tractor convention at the damn hotel. Well, that sucked.
Approximately a year before David leaves the band, you're in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
And some things happen that really, I mean, in my mind, they kind of typify the relationship you guys did have, David and you. I mean, you got definitely there's a lot of stories that revolve around your kind of back and forth.
Yes.
But this one's one of my favorites, so.
Okay.
So let's get into that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, David was kind of pulling away a bit in that he managed somehow to stay in Honolulu with the Rascals and sit on the beach and smoke dope and talk with them. He was the only one that did that. I stayed behind with him just to get him back to the house once we were finished with that, whatever that was. So David was always kind of doing his own thing. But for some reason in Hawaii, the shows were afternoon, maybe 1 o'clock. And we did one in Honolulu at 1 o'clock. And basically the show was finished for us at 2 o'clock. And we could head back to the house. And that's what we did. And when we got back there, it was a nice day. Dear old Jimmy had been given a little baggie of brownies. And of course, you assume brownies have marijuana in them. And they did. And I ate a couple. And there was something else in the brownies, unbeknownst to me, that I didn't know was in the brownies. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing purple haze here and a blue cloud over there. And, oh, a bird flew too close to me. And I was like, and I'm realizing I'm high on a psychedelic of some sort. What it was, I have no idea.
And where are you? You're on the North Shore?
I'm in the North Shore of Oahu at the beach house that they rented for us because the birds had been naughty boys the last time they were in Hawaii, and they didn't want them staying in Honolulu.
Is this Sunset Beach where the house was?
It is Sunset Beach.
Okay, okay.
The most violent surf of any place in the world, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't really know, but I...
Well, Waimea for sure.
I'm guessing, yeah. It was very close to that. Anyway, David's going out swimming or going down to the beach, and I went with him. And bathing suits, whatever. The Hawaiian guy stayed up at the house, and we went down to the beach. And then Dave decided, well, let's swim out. You want to swim out? Come on. Come outside or let's swim out. Okay. And I know I'm high, so I'm getting into the jello surf, if you will. It didn't feel like water, it felt like jello. It was thick and heavy and weird. Anyway, we're swimming, dog paddling out, whatever. You can't really do much more with the waves as they are. And we get out past the break point, I guess, is what they call it. And you look back and you go, oh, dude, we're really far away. And he's like, yeah, we probably shouldn't have come this far out. But there's not much you can do. You can't stay where the waves break.
Right.
Okay, yeah. You have to go out there if you're going to just goof around and dog paddle, and that's about all you can do. And then I started getting a little tired, and he did too. So I said, I'm going to go back in. He's like, okay, let's see if we can do it. You know, I body surf sort of, dog paddle sort of, and get to the beach. And before I can even stand up, another wave hits me and rolls my ass back into the water. Same with Dave. So we're back. Now we're back to going out where we can get past that so we can come in again. Because you can't really do that from midway. It's just not possible. And the waves were getting more later into the afternoon. It was about 4 o'clock, I guess. And they were getting pretty big. And we go out, and Dave tried to go in on his own. Same thing happened to him. I tried again. Same thing. Couldn't get to the beach. Couldn't get my feet down so I could even run.
So basically, you're trying to swim out with the break.
Right.
And then as you just stand up, another wave's hitting you from behind, dragging you back out.
Exactly.
Okay.
So because the sets were so close together, you couldn't get on the beach, stand up, and run before another wave would roll you back in, and the undercurrent would just take you back out.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that you're high on...
Oh, it didn't help at all that I was high. Okay. And Dave was high, but he was high from smoking.
Yeah.
He didn't have a brownie. Or two, like I did. So we're doing this enough, and I'm like, dude, I'm really getting tired. He's like, yeah, I'm tired too. I said, well, what are we going to do? And he didn't want to go when I did. I looked back and saw that the waves was coming and it wasn't quite as big as the last one. So I went in like a body surfing, staying on top of the wave, going in and getting on the beach, standing up, and I run like hell and I'm out and I'm exhausted. Okay. And I'm laying there on the beach and I look around and Dave is still out there trying to get the timing right of when you leave. He saw what I did, and he said it worked. So he wanted to do the same thing. And he waited between waves, saw a wave coming, wasn't too big, body surfed in, slammed him to the beach. He did a face plant on the beach and got up and staggered out just enough that he got out. And he laid down, and now we're both laying on the beach, which is about a 30-degree angle at that point in time.
This has got to be Waimea Bay.
Has to be. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, because the beach there can be very steep.
Oh, it was very steep. And, you know, it was so steep, in fact, when we started to go in, I remember thinking, man, do I really want to do this in my condition? Holy crap. Anyway, the jello happened, and then I laid on the beach for maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes to a half hour, and I was picking up beautiful colors of sand and putting them into my towel. You know, some great Hawaiian coral sand, which is not like other sand at other beaches. It's very hard to walk in, and it's beautiful. And I brought home a whole bunch of that sand in a bottle. Okay. In a bottle, and it is somewhere within my stuff, which has been, God knows, all over the world, but it's somewhere in my stuff, or it was. I don't know if I still have it. So here's Dave. I'm looking at Dave, and of course, he doesn't have his hat on, and his hair is just a mess because he face planted. He's got sand in his hair. He looks like crap, and he's trying to keep the hair out of his eyes. And he says, yeah, you know, because Dave was a sailor, right? He had a wooden sailing ship, okay, like a three-master schooner.
Right.
Okay, sailor. He's a sailor. So, you know, he should know better, right? Well, he says, yeah, you know, I kind of knew we shouldn't do that. Really, Dave? And I said, well, thanks a lot, because I didn't face plant, at least.
You're from St. Louis, which is has no ocean.
A river and river sand, and, you know, you wouldn't swim in that river if your life depended on it. But you could probably process photographs in the Mississippi River. Okay, there's that much chemicals in the water. Okay, but you wouldn't swim in it. You definitely wouldn't. And of course, I wouldn't swim in Hawaii either because of sharks that are there. But at that particular day, I wasn't paying attention. I was too high. And, you know, he suckered me in because he didn't want to go out alone. But after we did it, and then he realized, oh my God, we could die out here. And of course, he didn't say anything to me at the time out there. He waited until we were back in to tell me, oh, yeah, you know, we shouldn't have done that. Thank you, David. Thank you very much. You're beautiful. Don't ever change. And I'm sure David hasn't changed. He's still that guy today.
So it's no surprise that David was a pothead. Everybody knows that, right? But during this time period, there were some real issues with his behavior, right? And let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about some of his bad behavior. Could you kind of lead us in there?
Of course. So we were with CBS Records, okay? The Birds were with CBS Records. I say we. I was never signed to them. They always wanted to have photo sessions when we went to the East Coast, if we had time. Because what was happening in those days was every time they saw the band looked different. Face hair, no face hair, mustache, no mustache, curly hair, straight hair, what is it? Okay, and CBS wanted those pictures, plus the agents wanted those pictures because they wanted to know what they were selling so that they could show it to the promoters. And it was, you know, we had a session booked for New York with the CBS photographer. And this little guy in New York, and I don't remember what his name was, but he used to do all our photo sessions in New York. And straight off the bat, he's got a high lift, okay? He wanted to take a picture from up high looking down. And I'm not sure how it happened, but I think Michael took the high lift, was screwing around with the height of it, moving it up and down. And the photographer was walking across, and the railing, Mike pulled the pin on the railing, and the railing swung down, because it's hinged, swung down and hit the photographer right in the top of the head. So that's how we started the photo session. Now the photographer's kind of knocked loopy, but he's, you know, they put some water and ice on his head and Band-Aids, whatever, and protect him. And, you know, everybody is kind of disjointed. Anyone who has seen my book series, The Birds My Way, will see volume number one. I used a photo that I took that day of them sitting at a bench because the photo session kind of drug into the guy's injured. We don't know what we're doing, blah, 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 blah. We're not going to take those high pictures. He doesn't want to get on the high lift. And, you know, anyway, it was that kind of a day. And it got to be a lazy day, and they decided to do the photo shoot the next day, which we had the day off. We were working at night, but we had the day off. So, okay, that was good for us. And Michael felt bad because he had hit the guy in the head with the damn lift. So we go back to the hotel. We might have played that night too because we were working at Fillmore East in New York. Did those shows. Next day, we're dressed for photos again, and we show up at the same place, basically, which was in the Village in New York. They had a special place picked out, and they had paid for it and all that. The photographer showed up with a hard hat on that said birds on the front of it, okay, which was pretty funny, actually. And he started doing the photos, okay, and he'd line them up, go, here, McGuinn, you stand there, the four of them, boom, 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 boom. You know, it got a little tedious and boring while he set it up with the lights and making sure everything with the shadows were, you know, because we were outside, outdoors, and you don't control the sun, it does what it wishes, and, you know, we kept changing the lights and moving this, and the next thing I know, I see Dave, he's got a huge joint, I mean, 4 inches long and fat. And Dave's pot was always the best pot I'd ever smoked. He always got this stuff called ice bag, which was from Hawaii, and they dry it in ice bags, and it gives it miraculous powers or something. And it was always great stuff. So Dave, and I see it in his hand. He's kind of holding it down, and they're taking pictures the whole time. Guy's taking lots of pictures. Boom, boom, boom. And I see the thing in his hand. Well, 2 seconds later, he's got it up to his mouth and he's lighting it. It's not just holding it in his hand anymore. He's smoking it. And he offers it to, I think he offered it to Hillman. He didn't take any. Michael didn't take any. I took some, but I wasn't in the photos. And the guy took a break because he saw him smoking weed. And he was, you know, you could smell it. We were in Greenwich Village and anybody who was within 20 feet could smell we were smoking pot. So Dave smokes that joint, and then he smoked about half of it, and he put it out and put it in his pocket, and we went on with the photo session. Well, that word, I'm sure, went back to CBS because the guy got a bunch of pictures of Dave with the joint, and I got pictures of Dave smoking the joint as well.
Right.
In my collection of photographs, because I let them set up the light, and then I would take pictures, and they never stopped me. Usually they did in New York, but because the guy had been hit in the head, I think he was a little loopy still the next day. So he didn't stop me.
So because they set up that shoot,
yeah,
I mean, what's the deal with your photos from that session? I mean, are they...
They're mine.
They're yours.
They're mine.
So,
I have the negatives.
So we'll have those up on the website so people can look at them.
Yeah, they're mine. They're my pictures. Come on, I took them. I mean, the ones of them sitting at the table, CBS didn't even take pictures of that. I did that.
Right.
They were sitting there resting, smoking cigarettes, whatever, and I took pictures of them.
Right.
I stood up on the other bench and took some pictures from looking down on them. Anyway, I'm not going to ask that question even. But that was Dave in New York, and I'm sure nothing was ever said to me, anyway, about it. But I'm sure that photographer said something to CBS about it. He was smoking weed during the photo session. What do you say?
Did that piss the band off?
It didn't set well with them, no. It did not. Okay, I mean, Michael didn't really give a shit about anything, so he didn't really care. But McGuinn and Chris Hillman, they were the reason he put it out. He went for them. You know, he was like, David, put that out. Get away. Okay, stop doing that. Because, you know, they didn't take any, and they didn't want him doing it, right, around the photographers. It didn't set well with the band, and they made a comment about it afterwards and several other, you know, David, don't be smoking shit like that. Okay, fine. Well, this was in the period where Dave was kind of pulling back, kind of pulling away, all right? So as far as he's concerned, the photos they're taking in New York, he didn't give a shit about them because he knew he wasn't going to be in the band very long. One way or another, he was not going to be in the band. So we go to, you know, on the way home, we're in an American Airlines 707, first class as always. Five seats, Dave by the window, me across the aisle by the other window. So there's two seats and an aisle between us. And McGuinn and Hillman were up in front. And Michael, I think, was just ahead of David by himself. And, I'm just sitting there and all of a sudden it's dope. And I look over and Crosby's smoking a joint. Okay. And we had this stuff called Osium, which is a little canister that's about 6 inches high, and it's about as big around as a cigar, and it's a spray, tss, tss, and it clears the smell of marijuana immediately. I mean, it just goes away. And in those days, there was no restriction for shit like that.
Is it ozone?
Aerosol on a plane. What?
Is it ozone? What is it?
Osium.
Osium.
It's called. I don't know if it still exists, but you could buy it in the airport stores. And, you know, most of us had it because we would use it in your hotel room if you're smoking. You just spray it by the door.
Sure.
And none of that shit goes anywhere. And anyway, so Dave didn't have any. I spray some from my seat. And he kind of looks at me and he offers me the joint. So I go, okay. And I move over to the seat that's next to him, slide his guitar out of the way, and I take the joint and I take a hit off of it. I give it back to him. And, of course, it was his good Hawaiian pot. And, wow, man, at 30,000 feet, I had never smoked pot at 30,000 feet. Didn't really realize there was an issue with that, but there is. Okay, you get really high. Okay, and I took two hits, and then I sat back down in my seat, and I was just like, oh, my God. Well, the stewardess smelled it, and she came back. She walked back, and Dave hit it, of course. And McGuinn and Hillman were smoking cigarettes 2 aisles ahead of us. So she was a bit confused. But then she went up into the front to the captain's cabin where they were flying the plane. And a few minutes later, the captain came back and he walked through the cabin. But my osium had taken effect by then and the smell was pretty much gone. But he's just kind of looking at us. He didn't say anything. He just looked at us. And he turned around and went back to fly the plane. And now McGuinn and Hillman, who had smelled it before but weren't sure what it was, now they're looking over their seats back to Dave and I and Michael. And Michael's going, he's pointing to Dave, right? Of course. And they're going, dude, were you smoking? Did you light a joint? And he's like, yeah, you want some? And they're like, no, we don't. But, you know, he lit it up again. Because he got away with it the first time. So he figured, okay, I can do this again. So he lit it up again, and he took a couple of hits. He gave me a hit, and then he put it out. I sprayed some osium, and the stewardess came back again, and the captain came back again. But he still didn't say anything. He just looked at us. Okay, he just kind of stared at us.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? Because we're in first class. There's a drape hanging between first class and the back of the plane.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, we weren't really turning them on to anything, I don't think. But who knows? Anyway, that was the event. But the boys were like, dude, you were smoking on a fucking airplane? Really? And, of course, they brought it up many times after that. You know, uncool that was and blah, blah, blah. And it was uncool to do it at the CBS photo session. Yeah, we get it. But he didn't much give a shit. David's like, hey, I don't care.
At that time, were Hillman and McGuinn, were they more like straight edge?
They didn't get high. I don't know that I ever saw Roger get high in a session. Hillman would smoke once in a while in a session, not all the time. At CBS, of course, it was very straight. I mean, the engineers wore fucking white shirts and ties, okay? I rest my case.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It was like, Charlie Przanski would come find me and go, were they smoking dope out there? I said, geez, Charlie, I don't know. They were smoking cigarettes. I really didn't smell any dope.
Who's Charlie?
Charlie Przanski was the head of engineering at CBS in Hollywood. He wasn't an engineer. I don't think he went in the studio, but he was in charge of all the sessions and the engineers and making sure that they, 3 hours on, 1 hour lunch, 3 hours on.
Okay? Right, right.
That was his deal. It was always, he was always the one knocking on the door, okay? The glass, we used to put paper over they had a porthole in the door, it was glass, and he would knock on that. And we put paper over the fucker so he couldn't see in, okay? Not that we were doing anything, but because we weren't really allowed in the control room, even though a lot of times people would sleep on the couch up in front of the console.
Right.
Because you weren't allowed to touch the console. And the console was so funky anyway, because they were in the process of redoing all the studios and putting in real, consoles with faders instead of that big knob that, for the track.
Each track
had a big knob, one here, one there, one here, one there, offsetting. And it was horrible.
And what record were you guys working on? So this would have been...
We would have been working on Fifth Dimension.
Fifth Dimension. Okay. So yeah. That's that. So that this is before Triad and all that.
Oh, yeah. But they smoked in the studio a lot, really. David did.
But it was the same studio for that album, too.
Uh-huh. We always worked in Studio B at CBS. It was a middle-sized studio. Studio A was gigantic. It was cavernous. It was so big. That's where you put a full orchestra and record.
Right.
Okay. Studio B was smallish. Okay. Studio C was even smaller than B. It was like for a single voice overdub or, one instrument. But we always were in B. And, that was our home, really, Studio B at CBS in Hollywood until we went to Nashville. We recorded everything at that studio until we went to Nashville. And then we were only in Nashville maybe a week.
Right.
And came back to Studio B. It was just not too big. And it had a great booth that was raised up about 4 feet from the floor with a glass window looking in where all the sound effects shit were for the radio studios when those were radio studios. Those were live radio studios where they used to do live radio shows.
Right, of course.
That was before. But, that was Dave. He really, it was almost like he didn't give a shit anymore. And this was not close to him leaving, really.
Basically, he was always a problem. Things just got a little bit worse towards
Dave
the end.
Dave was always a problem. He was always pushing buttons. He was always pushing the limits of everything. Charlie Przanski wanted to talk to David before we started one of the albums. I don't remember what happened, but he wanted to talk to David. And I said, Charlie, that's really not a good idea. He said, why? I said, because it'll piss him off, and he'll do whatever you tell him not to do just because you tell him not to do it. He said, really? That's like a 10-year-old. I said, yeah.
Did you ever try to reverse psychology him on that?
David?
By telling him to do something to see if he then wouldn't do it?
No.
No.
That wasn't worth it. No, I mean, most of the stuff David did was really harmless. I mean, it wasn't. Smoking a joint in the plane, that didn't hurt anybody. It's just if the airline had caught him, it would have hurt us.
Yeah, he would have gone to jail, right?
Well, yeah, maybe. They'd arrested him when we got to the terminal. Okay, I don't know. This was way back, okay, so I don't know what it would have happened.
But you had mentioned before that he had some bad performances and that he had started to, like, decline shows.
When David was good, when David was on, David was a motherfucker. He could sing high harmony with anyone. He's really good at that. And they did. They booked us into New York, into the Village Gate, which is a jazz club, or was a jazz club, in the middle of Greenwich Village. And they booked us in there for a week, 7 days, okay? Two shows most days. And that's too long to be in a club in New York for us, all right? Because, once again, they only played so many songs a set. And they wanted to play the same songs every set. And sometimes people would come to the first show and stay for the second show. Well, guess what? They're hearing the same set. And what the club thought was they could sell alcohol, blah, a lot of alcohol. Uh-uh. These fuckers could barely afford the ticket to get in. They're hippies, okay? They don't have money to buy alcohol. Cokes, water, okay? And the club was pissed off after the first night because they didn't make any money on the bar. And that's how they normally make their money. And it wasn't my fault they booked him in for a week. That was their fault. They thought it was a great idea. And they paid good money for that idea. And, of course, all the newspaper people came from New York, which was a hub. And the CBS people from New York came to see the birds. And they're like, well, should we see both shows? I said, no, just see one. Just see the first show because it's probably going to be the same songs in the second show. I didn't say that, but I knew that that's what it was going to be. And they came, and they had a great time. They all got drunk on CBS. And that was probably the only night, one of the only nights that they made money, the club.
Yeah.
Because CBS guys put it on their tabs and made a lot of, gave drinks to everybody. So, it is what it is. That's, it was like, and I just called the agents and said, man, never book us at a club for 2 weeks.
How did the band?
Huh?
How did the band react to that?
Well, the photographs that Linda McCartney took, you can kind of see how they felt.
Oh, they're from that show?
They're from that show. She came to that show. She wasn't Linda McCartney at the time. She was Linda Eastman, okay? And everybody equated that with Eastman Kodak. But that was not Eastman Kodak. That was just her name, okay? She wasn't connected to Eastman Kodak. But she came and took pictures. And they were kind of, they suck, kind of. I have, because I got all the proofs of all that stuff, and it was just like, oh, really? Michael couldn't have cared less. She took individuals, and then she took some of McGuinn talking to Hillman, and, David talking to himself. And, it was very weird, okay? And she did that in their dressing room, which was a jazz dressing room.
Right.
Terrible. Terrible accommodations for jazzers, my God. Just a room. And they didn't want to give us ice. They didn't want to give us Cokes or beer or anything. We had to pay for everything if we wanted it. That was how the week went. It was terrible. I thought it was awful. And the press did too. They slammed them big time. Because I guess the reporters went to two shows in one night. Not a good idea. Okay. Not a good idea.
And that was the thing with that original band though too, is that, I know you've mentioned to me that they weren't actually that good.
They weren't a garage band.
Yeah.
They weren't guys that sweated and toiled at rehearsals in a garage for a year and played gigs on the weekends. That wasn't what they were. They were put together, and Terry Melcher came in and as the producer, and he realized that they weren't good players. They weren't good enough to play on a hit record. And the only one that was allowed was McGuinn with the 12-string. And that's the only reason, because that was the sound of Mr. Tambourine Man. And Terry used him on the session, but he also used Mike Dacey on guitar. He used Larry Nechtel on bass. He used Hal Blaine on drums. And he used Leon Russell, played piano and guitar. He used the big players. That was the recording team in Hollywood.
They did all
the hit records, that team of people.
Sure.
And that's who Terry used. And he got I think they did 3 songs altogether in those sessions.
And you've said that David, I mean, barring the thing in Texas, is there another like story that kind of highlights what kind of performer David was?
A performer?
Yeah, a performer, or like how he, you know.
Well, okay, Monterey Pop Festival. The very first pop festival in Monterey, California, put on by Terry Melcher, was one of the producers of the show, and Lou Adler from the Mamas and Papas produced the show as well. And, you know, everyone in Hollywood, if you got invited to Monterey Pop Festival, you were in. And it was a great show. It really was. And they did a very smart thing, boxed off an area in front of the stage with wire, and people from the performance side could sit in those seats and watch the shows. So you're playing to your peers first, and then the audience is out there. It was a great way to see a show, sitting down in those seats. It was like you could look up, you know, you look up Otis Redding's nose while he's singing. Okay. I mean, you know, it was that intimate. And then backstage, there was a huge dining room, a restaurant for everybody to eat, just the entertainment. And it was, you know, it was a great scene. The whole scene was very good, very well done. And Dave, he asked me for his guitar after the sound check. And I'm like, why? I have to go play with some other people. Well, David played with Dills, Nash, and Young at Monterey Pop Festival, as well as the Byrds.
Were they even? They weren't even a band yet.
Who? Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Yeah,
yeah, they were.
Yeah. Okay, but it was just.
Well, it was Buffalo Springfield. Okay.
Yeah.
It was, but it's the same band basically.
But he went up there and played with them.
He went and played with them, right in the center of the stage, wearing his hat. I don't think he wore the cape, but he had the hat. Yeah. Okay, and nobody else did that. Nobody else did that, but David did it. And he kept it away from the band. He didn't tell them he was doing it. He just did it. And I have a picture of McGuinn and his wife and Anya and Chris Hillman sitting in the audience together watching David perform with them. And it freaked him out big time.
That's like a prelude of
exactly. That's a prelude of what he was going to do.
It's foreshadowing. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, in a few years, what was going to happen? He was going to play with those guys because it was all the same guys.
Right.
Stephen Stills, Neil Young, not Graham Nash, but Dewey playing drums, you know, and Palmer playing bass. It was a bunch of guys that were all going to play together in a different forum later on.
Right.
And Dave's right there in the middle with them. Messina was up there. Messina was playing guitar.
This is a perfect segue for the next episode.
Yeah. Anyway, that's David. Okay.
Yeah.
And he didn't, you know, I said, dude, what are you doing with your guitar? He said, I'm going to play with Steven and the gang. I said, oh, for fuck's sake. Does the band know? He's like, no, and please do not tell him. So, of course, I didn't. I said nothing. I knew, but I said nothing because it's not my place to say that. That would have just pissed them off ahead of time. And there was no reason for that. Let them see him doing it. And, you know, he did the sound check with them. Okay, but they weren't around. Okay, they weren't there for that. I was, because I did most of this. I stayed on the stage most of the time at Monterey Pop Festival. I was on the stage doing all whatever, moving amps and.
Right, and we're actually going to do an episode.
You have to,
about
that festival.
That festival.
It was a great deal. It was really a good deal
because there's so many stories from that.
Lots of stuff
from that festival that it deserves its own episode.
Yeah. But David, I mean, that was like a slap in their face. And in the Byrds show, they did material from their brand new album, and no one had ever heard those songs before. They didn't do like Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn. They didn't really focus on those songs. They did all new material, mostly new material. And everybody was just like, whoa, what the fuck the song is that? Okay, and it's good songs. But those are songs that they hadn't rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and played live many times.
Right.
Some of those they had never played live before, only in the studio. And that was you know, but that was their, that was the Byrds' downfall. They did not rehearse. Their rehearsal was in the recording studio before they did the track.
Yeah.
And then they never rehearsed it again until they played it live. That was a rehearsal, live on stage in front of an audience. That's how they did it. They wouldn't, and I, like an idiot, didn't know that, didn't care about that in the early, early days of my career with them. And I set up a rehearsal in the 9000 building, 9000 Sunset, on an empty floor that wasn't yet occupied. It wasn't yet built out. I put the amps there, blah, 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 blah. Had it set up just like I would have them on stage. And they showed up. I booked 3 days. They showed up the first day. It was fine. The second day, it got to a bunch of arguing and bitching about, who's going to sing Gene's song? No, I'm not going to sing it, blah, blah. And I'm just like, oh, my God. They didn't even show up the third day. And Eddie came up to the floor and was laughing. I said, what's the matter, dude? He said, I knew they wouldn't do 3 days, okay? I said, why didn't you tell me? He said, well, you know, you tried. I mean, you tried to get him to rehearse. I get it. He said, they need to rehearse. They do. But I knew they weren't going to do it. And sure as shit, they, you know, second day was fights almost. And third day, I had the equipment picked up, taken back to the warehouse. It's like over. So, you know, they never really rehearsed except when they were in the recording studio. And then they'd play it like 10 times before they'd start recording it.
Right.
And then that was it. Next time you heard it was on stage. Yeah, well, hey, I didn't have to set up rehearsals after that. That was, you know, then the first rehearsals I did have to set up were when people started leaving and I had to replace them. Those rehearsals,
well, of course, yeah,
had to be done.
New members, which there's so many lineups.
A new member, I mean, you have to prep them for it, except for John York when he replaced Hillman one day to the next. Hillman left, York in the next day, no rehearsal. He did fine. Can I say? Okay. He did. He did fine.
Yeah.
He did not need a rehearsal. He was just fine. So welcome to the Byrds, my friends.
Yeah. A lot more to come on that. In fact, we'll wrap up here. But we have part two of this David Crosby series coming up on the next episode, which actually is already up because we decided to launch the show with 3 episodes. So enjoy that. And thanks for listening. Music for the show has been provided by the very talented Patrick Lyons and Clayton Lithicum, and our editor is Yikang Yang.